You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Stefan Meyer, who is the James P. Gorman Professor of Business Strategy and the Chair of the Management Division at Columbia Business School. Previously, he worked at the Center for Behavioral Economics and Decision Making at the Federal Reserve Bank. This is a really good book. It's called The Employee Advantage: How Putting Workers First Helps Businesses Thrive. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Stefan Meyer, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Kelly, for having me.
When my kids were little, the release of a new Harry Potter book was like this big event. Our local bookstore, which was the bookseller in Lincoln Square in Chicago, would stay open to release the book at midnight, and the kids would dress up, and there were games. It was totally awesome. You open your new book on July 8th, 2000, with the release of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, and something unusual that Jeff Bezos did at a still struggling startup called Amazon. What was that?
Yeah, so back then, again, as you mentioned, you know, Amazon was young, you know, didn't make any money, and he decided, you know, for his customers, and he was back then, you know, he was like a book seller. He was like getting Harry Potter as soon as possible into people's hands was really important, because like everybody was waiting for that new installment, and people wanted to read it right away. They didn't want it to wait another day or even a week. And so he invested a lot of money to make sure that people had that book in hand on the Saturday when it was released. And that was controversial at that point because, you know, it costed money. They were not making any profits at that point. But Bezos decided, you know, it's going to be really, really important for our customers. They're going to love us when they actually have that book in their hands right away. Some of his executives were not so thrilled, and I'm sure some of his investors were not, but he decided, no, that's the right thing to do. And in the end, he was right. It got a lot of positive press, in addition to people could actually read the book right away on that Saturday when it was released. So, yeah, it was a very customer-centric action that he did, and that's kind of how I opened the book. And a very positive and feel-good story. And now, if you know Amazon...
this is where it turns.
There is another side of it.
Yes. Yeah, maybe not a great place to work.
Exactly. So it's, you know, on the one hand, they're like those super customer-centric organization, you know, this Harry Potter story being one of them, and Bezos has, you know, leaves a chair at every important meeting empty for the customer. He would read customer emails personally, and then escalated it if something he felt like the customer was unhappy and his executives needed to do something about it. But what is also well known is, you know, they're maybe not so employee-centric. And that's one, obviously, in their fulfillment centers. You know, there is... it's a miserable work environment. And the New York Times had like a bunch of like investigative journalistic pieces on that. There's a lot of accidents that happen, and it's a work environment that is not particularly pleasant. But that's also true for the engineers. And, you know, just recently when they decided that, you know, everybody has to go back to the office 5 days a week, it was kind of reinforced that they're treating their customers very differently than they're treating those other important stakeholders, which are their employees.
And this book, which is called The Employee Advantage, is talking about this other area of focus. And you even say that for the bulk of your career, right, you've taught from that sort of customer-centric POV. When did the flip happen for you?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Kelly, because, you know, for me, as I write in the book, you know, I teach strategy most of my time. I do work in my research on like behavioral economics, but like a lot of my teaching at the business school here is about like how can companies be more successful financially. And we focused a lot on customers and customer centricity. The pandemic,
yeah,
like put it on top of mind that like something is not working. Yeah. Well, you know, there is this, and I think I mentioned it in the business book, you know, I quote Lenin, who says, you know, there is decades where nothing happens, and then there are weeks where decades happened. And obviously he was not talking about the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, but somehow during the pandemic, it just put a spotlight on like what is actually not working so well in the workplace. Remote work is just one of them, you know, where like for many, many years we thought like that's impossible to do. And then during the pandemic, I was like, wait a second, I'm not sure it's impossible. I mean, maybe it's actually the right way to do it. But it's not just that. There were a lot of instances where we figured out like something is not right, and that led them to, you know, quiet quitting or like great resignations. People like thinking, do I really want to like this drudgery at work? Do I really need to do that? And so it put for me as well, you know, put on top of mind that like we're not doing it exactly right. And I was always teaching when I taught about strategy, I talk about the customers, but also the suppliers. And then I focus on the customers. But some of the suppliers are employees. And I thought like, well, why don't I combine kind of my work on human motivation and what I do with strategy and bring those two together? So the pandemic really made it salient for me that something is not right. But it's not just the pandemic. There is like a trend that was going on for many, many years. And it's also not bouncing back. So it's not like, oh, after the pandemic, people
right
wanted a little more and now they're back to, no, actually we don't. I think it's something that if in the future, that's what I argue, if organizations want to be successful, they have to be employee-centric in addition to customer-centric.
So the not hidden thesis of this podcast is that it's Milton Friedman's fault. So if we just want to cut to that, that is what I suggest.
Milton Friedman or Jack Welch.
Or Jack Welch. Well, that's, you know, he inherited that mantle. Because, you know, for me, working at a theater, right, pandemic happens. And the adage, there's this adage in my field that I always embraced, which is the show must go on. We wear it like a badge of honor. Then COVID happens and you're like, okay, the show maybe must not go on. And then you interrogate who came up with that phrase, which was theater producers, not really talking to the sick actors who were forced to come in and do work when they were sick. And again, it was like, oh, wow, this thing that I really felt was part of my identity, which is why I sort of held on to it, was also potentially an instrument of abuse. And okay, so that's it. And the modern workplace is what, 140 years old? It's not necessarily that old, and it was that for a reason, and things do change. So as I think exactly what you said, which is it wasn't just COVID, but that certainly sped it up because everything that happened immediately, everyone had to pivot. Mm-hmm. And then when they realized they could, then you start questioning like, okay, well, what is it going to be now? And of course, all over LinkedIn every week is like, well, 3M is now saying everyone has to come back to work. I'm like, I don't know how this is going to work out.
Yeah.
I actually don't think it's going to work out necessarily well.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more, Kelly. You know, like there is this 100 plus year history of like what the work and workplace look like. And it changes occasionally. You know, we had like then Saturdays off and like did 5 day work. And like, why is 5 days the ideal number? Why is how we treat our employees at the moment and squeeze out more from them, why is that optimal? And, you know, when we think about like Bezos, for example, like Amazon, they were revolutionary because they would put customers more first than others. You know, I've never met an executive who doesn't say customers are important and my employees are the most important asset. So they all say that. But who's actually following through? That's a very different story. That's true with customers as well. So, you know, Amazon was like obsessed about what customers do. And I think that was part of their success. And I think we can do the same with employees because it's just not cutting it to say, oh, employees are the most important asset and then not follow through. And the pandemic really put it, as you said, on top of mind is like, wait a second. What is actually optimal? We obviously, if you look at those miserable engagement levels that we have, you know, like according to Gallup, like 65% of Americans are disengaged at work. So we're obviously either the employees are not the most important asset or they're doing a pretty terrible job in making them the most important asset, or most likely both of them.
Well, and you phrase it in a way that's very simple, but I think very provocative, which is you say, quote, employees and customers are the same humans after all. So maybe it's being human centric as because that's what we're dealing with. And in understanding that the same things that drive maybe a customer's behavior can drive an employee's behavior. And those things always intersect. You don't have one without the other. It is like, that's the other thing, right? We want A plus B to equal C. And it's like, no, A, B, and C are all happening at the same time. And you got to kind of figure that out. And it's complex. I get that.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, I completely agree. Like that, you know, they're the same human beings. So, you know, when we think, oh, you know, brands with purpose, like customer need more purpose, like the brands that we do need to be aligned with their values. True. But those same humans work in organizations where probably their values also has to be aligned with what the organization does. Or, you know, we think about customers like, oh, you know, they need like a personalized experience. You know, I can't like show you just one movie when I'm Netflix. I need to figure out what's the movies that you actually want to watch based on your history and whatever. And then I show you you know, I'm sure Kelly's Netflix account looks nothing like anybody else's. That's the whole point of personalization. And then you come to work and it's like one size fits all. And as the same humans, I mean, they're used to personalization, rightly so, and they expect more at work as well. And those organizations who figure that out, I think, are going to be on top. And those who don't, who are like stuck in, you know, 50, 20, 30, 40 years ago, they will not.
Yeah, I think this is where AI can be very powerful inside organizations in terms of, we think it's impossible to gather all that individual information. Like, we got a tool right now that can do it. And as it interacts with a human being, a caring human being having a conversation, that's a win-win.
Yeah. No, exactly. I love this, exactly what you said, because it's hard. Personalization is hard. You know, I talk like in the book at one about like those just right tasks, you know, that like what is really motivating is for humans to have like those exact right tasks, meaning they're not bored, they're not overwhelmed. Now, the problem with those tasks is like once you master it, you get bored. You know, you need a new you need a new challenge and so on. And so sometimes, like jokingly, I say like to executives that I teach, well, now it's easy. You know, the only thing you have to do is to figure out for each and every one of your employees What's their just right tasks? Mm-hmm. You know, match them to the right tasks and constantly update. Because and I was like, well, that's hard. And then I said, well, that's exactly your point. That sounds like an AI job. That's what Netflix does. It figures out what are you watching and what I'm watching. And once I'm done with, like, you know, sometimes I have, like, watch a bunch of nature documentaries. And then after a while, I get a little bored of those. And, like, Netflix knows that. Oh, now he's not watching nature documentaries anymore. And now he's moved on and shows. And that's, like, solutions that, like, organizations can actually use and already starting using, the ones who are at the forefront, where they use AI-powered tool to, you know, to offer those very tailored experiences, project-based, that, like, people can actually have, like, you know, use their skills optimally, learn more, and then the data learns what skills you have, and then they show you the other tasks and so on and so forth.
Also, the idea that it's hard means that it's probably worth it, because things that are really easy usually aren't. Like, I mean, this is like, yes, we not learn this lesson over and over and over again? It's just, this is just a whole idea of, like, you know, there's life and humans and science and all that. Then there's work, which is somehow different because you have to dress differently to go into it. And you don't even have to do that anymore. So it's that's what I love about this. All right. You also talk about this topic, which is fascinating to me, because it will probably not surprise you that Second City gets hired to go into many Fortune 500 companies to teach a lot of skills around listening and collaboration. And so many times it's generational communication. Mm. And everyone is convinced that this one generation is lazy and doesn't want to do the other thing. And it's like, I don't actually think that's the case. I think what I understand from the data is that generations are different in terms of maybe where they start and what they have at that time. But generally speaking, we want things at different ages. And I remember as a young man being very impatient and probably annoying. And that continues with the 20-year-olds that I work with. I was that, they are that. That's what, right. And so you have a POV on this, right?
I have a very strong view on this. I do actually, sometimes I tell people this quote from this man who said, you know, kids these days, so I'm not paraphrasing, kids these days kind of love luxury, you know, they have disrespect of authority, they're like tyrants. And then I showed this quote, and like all the executives are like, yeah, kids these days. Turns out it's a quote by Socrates, the Greek philosophers, because the term kids these days is as old as their kids. And every generation thinks, like, you know, they walked uphill both ways to work, and new kids these days don't. I think it's an easy way out, you know, kind of saying, oh, kids these days are so lazy and it's their fault and not ours. But what really happens, exactly what he says, you know, opportunities change. You know, it's true that in order to make a career, you don't need to work in the same organization 50 years as we did in the past, where like careers were like you started entry level, you worked up the corporate ladder, and that's why the way you make a career. Now it's different. You don't need to do that anymore, because those skills are like not firm specific, and you can actually zigzag. You know, you have careers that like, oh, you can stop, you get a new experience, you go somewhere else, and that's actually how you make a career. Has nothing to do with the preferences of younger generations being like, you know, not loyal or like, mm-hmm. Or having like values that are not work related or whatnot. Yes, I'm pushing back a lot about this notion of like kids these days, because I just don't, first of all, I don't think it's true. And it's also way too easy get out to blame it on the kids these days.
College kids protesting. When has that ever happened? Like, do you read a history book?
Yeah, exactly.
That is what they do. Well,
I'm at Columbia University, where there is not just this year where there was protests. It has a long history of protests.
Yeah. Like seriously, I remember at Northwestern there were shanty towns when I was in, you know, when they were protesting apartheid. I mean, it was like halfway across the world, and still, of course. So you talk to a number of companies. We, from the very beginning, did work with Zappos, so much so that they had a yes and lending library where they had improv books as well as other books in there. So talk a bit about Zappos and why they're an example in your book.
Yeah, Zappos is really interesting and also a little close to my heart because I experienced it firsthand what they did. You know, that if you think about like e-commerce and shoes, that's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea.
Because, I mean, even if you know your size, you know, you go into the store and, you know, like I'm a whatever and a 9.5 or a 10, and the shoes just don't fit. And so if you're an but in the store, obviously you don't buy it, but e-commerce, you buy it and then you return it. And the returns are hard and people are frustrated and whatever. So customer service is really important. I think Zappos, he figured out like that's an important aspect of what keeps like customer loyal in a business that is hard because there is a lot of returns. Now, best practice in call centers is very strict scripts and short times. So they say like, okay, you have 15 seconds. There's a call comes in. You have 15 seconds. You have like those 3-4 scripts. There is very little discretion of what call center employees have to do. And as a result, it's a miserable experience, most of them, but it's efficient. You know, I guess that's the idea. It's 15 seconds, you know, you don't have to pay as much. Zappos did it not that way. They actually decided, no, you can talk to that customer as long as you want. There is no scripts. And that creates a very human interaction. Now, I had that experience where I like moved, and I talk about it in the book. So I moved from a big building in New York City to a smaller one, didn't update the address, ordered the book, ordered a Puma of sneakers. They came to the big building, and like they didn't know where it went. And so I called the call center, what the heck is going on with my Puma sneakers? Now, that woman who was in Las Vegas in the call center there, I was in New York. It was winter. So she first talked with me about I had a cold. So she talked to me about the cold and like gave me tips about what she would do with the cold. Then she looked into the book, you know, my shoes and like decided, yeah, I didn't update the. So clearly my mistake. Then then she upgraded me to a VIP member and send me a new pair of shoes. Now, I was blown away.
Sure.
I was like, wow. I've never called the call center anymore, but ever since, I'm like a loyal Zappos customer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that experience was really, really important. Now, what they need to then to do on the back end is, you know, that's why I talk about in the book, give their employees, empower them, you know, to improvise.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's kind of part of the work you're doing them because they actually have to now, you know, make sure that they know what to say that or, you know, work on the fly and be very customer centric in that sense. But you need to empower them to, you know, make the right calls. And the right calls might be an hour long call for that one customers, and they decided to do that. And so that's why like I really enjoy, or I think like the example of Zappos is so great, where they give people autonomy to do the right thing. I mean, it comes, I talk about Zappos in multiple instances because also then you need the right people to do that. You know, not everybody works well under such a, you know, very flexible and empowered environment. So they take great care of like selecting the right people, making sure that the right people are there. And so it's important to do that. But I think the most important insight I got from them is like, you know, you empower them, you have happy employees as well, and that leads to happy customers.
Yeah. A few years back, we had Horst Schultz from the Ritz on the podcast. And I think their deal was you had up to $2,000 per customer to if something went wrong, lost a suit, wrinkled it. Yep, here, I buy a new one. And it was just like, you know, the reason that brand is that brand for a reason, and that people go back to it, and people will pay. And look, even with Bezos, you know, like, I'm hooked on Amazon. I've got the Prime membership. There's a thing about that interaction that works for me. I'm also a person who lives in the world and hears the reports. And, you know, if something else comes along, that's going to be better. I mean, I remember when I deleted my Uber and just used my Lyft, and I have not gone back. And I don't know if Lyft is that much better of a company, but it was just something that was like, well, they both do the same thing for me. And, you know, so in chapter 4, you seem to suggest that simply buying a ping pong table for the company office will not make that company more innovative. So how dare you, sir?
What are you, an avid ping pong player?
I am. We actually had, I actually was going to bring this up in the Second City break room. There's one of the, it's not air hockey. It's actually older school than that with the, it's like a foosball thing, but with, you know, okay, hockey. And I have yet to see anyone play it. It's been in there for now a few months. I've never seen anyone play it. I have nothing. I like ping pong. I have nothing against ping pong. We do a lot of work in Silicon Valley, and there are a lot of ping pong tables. No, I don't think it makes people more innovative, and I don't think you do either.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I actually go, I call like, I use ping pong tables as an illustration of what I call like ping pong table solutions, like two easy solutions to be employee centric. That's ping pong tables. That's free snack. That's free yoga classes.
The wellness programs.
And so on and so forth. And I think there are two problems with those. One is, let's assume ping pong tables are really the kicker. You know, like if you have a ping pong table, innovation goes through the roof.
Yeah.
Now, if that's true, everybody has a ping pong table. There is no differentiation, coming back to what he said before about, you know, if it's too easy, everybody can do it. Yeah, it's probably too easy. Now, but the second problem is more like, and everybody knows that, ping pong tables are not the kicker. There is nobody who chooses to work in a company or leaves a company because they have or don't have a ping pong table or a kombucha tap or whatever the new version of those perks are, because it's much more around like the culture, how, you know, what you mentioned before, how we treat each other, you know, the social interactions. That's actually the important part. Now, is that easy? No, that's hard to do. But that's exactly why those companies who do the hard work, you know, can actually distinguish themselves from the others. And if it were just, wellness classes or kombucha taps or kind bars, that's not differentiating. And I talk, you know, gaming companies are like, some of those gaming companies have like terrible toxic work cultures.
They all
have ping pong tables and slides in the offices and whatever, all those perks. But that doesn't make it a good workplace.
Yeah, there is a certain comedy institution, not Second City, and I'm not going to mention who it is. So funny, so brilliant at what they do. The most miserable work environment I've ever walked into in my life. And the people who work there would say the same thing. Yeah. And it's just, you know, and it misses the point because it tends, and I think this is just true for, especially in the creative arts a lot, where bad behavior was romanticized. You know, I know this from the early days at Second City. There were directors who threw chairs, and everyone's like, well, that's, you know, there's a crazy genius. And I'm like, I think you can be a genius and be kind. I think that exists as well. And the other thing, and this comes across, this is brought up in your book, which is there's a reason we all work at Second City and we're not at McKinsey. And we don't make as much money. We would all make way much more money at McKinsey, and many of us are capable of working at a place like McKinsey. But money isn't the sole. I need money. I would like more money. It's helpful for raising kids and insurance and retirement and all that. But if it were in any way the top motivator, there's no way I would work here, and I want to work here. So talk to us a bit about money as motivation.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, as you said, you know, money is not unimportant. And especially like on the lower end of the income distribution, it's critically important, you know. Yeah. And if you don't make enough money and to make end meets, that actually affects productivity significantly negatively, because you're always worried and like, and you just can't do your best work. But once you reach a certain level, money is actually not that important anymore. And then there are other motivators that are critically important. And that's where a lot of my book is about kind of how to humanize work beyond monetary incentives. Because, you know, there's very few people who get in the morning out of bed and think like, you know, today I'm going to increase the return on invested capital of that company by like 1%. I mean, very few
people. Milton Friedman thought that when he woke up. Milton Friedman thought about that before he started making his coffee.
I'm not even sure Milton Friedman. He probably could have. He could have made much more money if it were not a professor, I will guess. I don't know. I think
he was getting paid in other ways. There was other checks coming into his account.
That's probably also true. But I have like some of those economists. You know, I'm an economist by training, yes. So there is like a lot of some of those hardcore economists say like, no, people are motivated only by money. It's like, what are you doing then? In a university, why are you not working at an investment bank?
Yeah, why are you not CFO
because
somewhere?
You're obviously smart enough to do that. But like something about the work in academia,
graduate students, what are you doing? Absolutely.
So yeah, so there are like I think there are a lot of different motivators that really get people going, and I think that's the levers that leaders can actually use to humanize work and like make this a much better work environment and workplace.
So staying on the money thing for a second,
yeah.
Because the Dan Schulman PayPal story I'd never heard. And I thought that was fascinating. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Schulman at PayPal, like came in and thought like, let's get a good story out. And like, because they paid over above market rate and decided, you know, to investigate, like, how amazing are they really? And now in PayPal, turns out, you know, not all of them are engineers. You know, they have a lot of call center employees and frontline workers that are not paid that much, but they pay them above market rates. So he expected this to be an amazing story. Turns out it was not. A lot of this frontline worker actually did not have enough money to actually save. They didn't have enough money after, you know, you pay. And there is this metric that they use, like, after you pay everything you need to pay, how much money is left for, like, you know, stuff that happens, like a dental, like your kid suddenly, you know, breaks the electronics and you need more of that and so on and so forth. And a lot of them didn't have that. He couldn't also save anymore, and so he was shocked and said like, well, that's not great, and decided to really do something about this. Increased the wage, gave a lot of them options in stock options in the organization, helped them with financial planning to make sure that they got much closer and had much more left after they paid everything, and as a result, productivity increased dramatically. Now he tries to convince with a bunch of other executives for others to do the same, and there is where money really matters. You know, as I mentioned, on the lower end of the value of the income distribution, it really does matter that you have enough money at the end of you know, of the month, because if you don't, you know, it's just really hard to concentrate and look focus on actually work when you have to think about all the time, like, how do I pay tuition, how do I pay health insurance, how do I pay X, Y, and Z, how do I pay, you know, holiday presents for the kids. But that really affects like the productivity and the quality of the work that people do.
So I have a love-hate relationship with coaching and the term as applied in different ways. Here's where I love it, which is totally understand it in sports, totally understand it in my field, because although Second City has directors, most of the improv theaters that do pure improv, they're called coaches, and they are coaching. They're coaching you. Mm-hmm. There's a thing, there's a term in theater called side coaching, which is you know, helping someone along with their skills in terms of that, motivating them, all those things. My hate part of it is that everyone seems to, when they lose a job, then they become a coach, and they suddenly have an expertise that I don't see that they've got to be coaching in what really is probably analysis or therapy that they're doing. But I think when you talk about leaders becoming coaches, I think you mean it more in the way that I'm talking about it with my field, which is really as motivators and as understanding what position you might be best at and how to get you really good at that position through the skills building. Did I have that correct?
You have that absolutely correct. So how I mean it, and I talk in particular in one chapter, you know, one of the motivators, human motivators that I talk about is autonomy. So people really want autonomy, which the flip side of that is like trust. You know, you can only get autonomy if I trust you, then you empower. Then you can be empowered. Now, what people sometimes miss, I think, is if you think about like how often I'm involved, and how much flexibility I give you. You know, if you look at like the worst type of boss is a micromanager. Yeah. Is like always involved in order to control and doesn't give any autonomy. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is a lot of people, when they give autonomy, they scale back on involvement as well because they think, oh, Kelly, you go for this. You know, I give you the power to do this and I'm out of the picture.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is like then all the interactions we're having are negative because, you know, I might not have given you the right brief and eventually like you go in the wrong direction and then I have to correct this. And so forth. So what I say is what you actually have to do, you have to be involved maybe more in order to make you successful in the empowerment. I call a coach, like an engaged, very frequently coach to really support kind of what you're doing and be on the sideline as like supporting you, not to like tell you, you know, Kelly, this is how you do it because I know better. It's really right. More like to be on the side and like helping with that empowerment and setting empowerment up for success instead of for failure.
Well, it's like feedback, right? Which is everyone hates feedback because it hasn't been made a norm. And at our place, the audience is giving you feedback for 2.5 hours during a show. They are laughing or they're not laughing. And yes, it doesn't feel great when they're not laughing, but the reason they are mostly is because we've tested it out in front of them. And then we have directors and producers who can help note to get that. So at a certain point when everything's running, you don't need the feedback. You do check-ins and that sort of thing. Back in the process, more feedback. So that sort of frequent, you know, short, frequent feedback.
Absolutely. It's that feedback, you know, that you can actually get better. I talk about this company, Birdsorg. You know, there's a Dutch home care provider who is the largest in the Netherlands, super successful in terms of like patient satisfaction, but also to a significantly lower cost than their competitors. And how they do that is like by giving those nurse teams, so they're teams of 12 nurses who work in teams, almost full autonomy. They can do basically whatever they want. So they can decide how they deal with the patients, they hire, and so on and so forth. But the important part is that they have this feedback mechanism. They actually have tech solutions to share a lot of feedbacks because it's impossible to learn if you don't know. You know, even if you're empowered, you want to know, do I do it right? I mean, as you said, you know, you're a stand-up comedian. You want to know, did that work? Did that didn't work? And like getting that constant feedback really helps to adjust. And if the feedback is in a positive way, I want to support you, that's awesome. If the feedback is what often happens for like micromanagers, is like to control you, to basically tell you how much you suck, then it's not motivating. But if it's actually to support, you want to have a lot of feedback. And Birdsorg does that to the best. The teams work in an autonomous way, but it's combined with that feedback mechanism that they're able to scale that because it's an IT solution. It's basically technology that supports autonomy create those coaches almost like a coach mechanism.
Yeah, that's to say that's when I'm speaking positively about AI. That's what it is. It's like, no, this is like, I think there's a better future we can look at with this. Okay, in a moment, I'm going to be asking you for a yes and story. But before that, I did not know it was mandatory in Switzerland that you serve. and you had to do this, right?
Yes.
Take us through, this is maybe my favorite part of the book, is what you learned, what you saw when you were in the services with these elite two branches.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So notorious army, by the way, like Switzerland, constantly getting in it.
Exactly. Always getting into fights. Don't tell anybody, but like the army, the experience I had, like they would not win anything. You have to go to the army. I did so too. I was a hospital soldier, so I spent most of my time in the hospital, did that training there. And when I served on those repetition courses, I was on one of those elite platoons where I have like those two elite troops. One was like, I don't know, it was like the Marines and like something like that. So the equivalent of those. Now, they would never send those guys out on their free days at the same time, because when they would get into fights, which is interesting. You know, they're like, they're all Swiss. They're there to protect the country from
Swiss military.
I don't know what threat, but like this imaginary threat that comes at one point.
We're trying to take away your chocolate.
Exactly. And then when they're together, you know, they actually fight each other. And so that then led me to, you know, and I do a bunch of work in my behavioral economic scholarly work and thinking about what group identity does. And there is like they created those very strong group identities, but not for the Swiss Army, but for those smaller units that they had. And when they would come together, there is all like always in and out group, you know, there's the otherness. And then those otherness, they will kind of fight over that. So, and then I talk a little bit in the book about like, you know, how to actually create an atmosphere where we all work together. And it's not, there is a real dark side. And the funny part about it is, you know, when I talk now about with executives about remote work, they always say, this like really affects our culture badly. You know, when we do remote work, we have to be in the office. And I always tell them, well, you know, I guess it's when we were all in the office, like 50% of workplaces had toxic work cultures. It's just because we're together doesn't create a good atmosphere. In fact, it's much easier to have microaggressions when we're together than when it's over Zoom. And those different groups are part of what is problematic in organizations that, you know, we have the sales department is fighting or thinks they're better than the engineers or vice versa, and they're fighting against each other. So, and especially when there is competition, when there is, and now there is actually the dark side of also monetary incentives, you know, when I give pay for performance, whatever. And we studied this in the Swiss Army, when you have like different groups and you give them some award if they're better, they start to literally fight each other quite dramatically. So we have to be very intentional on creating a workplace where, you know, those social interactions are very positive, are not governed by those groupthink, you know, are actually supporting on the healthy, a human-centric kind of work environment, which sounds like that's the work you're doing as well in some of those companies, you know, because it's all about like how you listen, how you communicate with each other. That's kind of what creates most value. Social skills is a really important part in every, you know, every position in an organization, whether you're a team member, whether you're a boss, a team leader, whether you're the manager of multiple teams, those social skills and working out kind of what are positive social interactions is really, really important.
Yeah, the section where you talk about measuring of collective intelligence, I was like, well, this is exactly what we do. The exercises, we have a simple exercise called Last Word where we have a conversation. The only requirement is that each of our sentences start with the last word the other person said. So it forces you, hopefully, to listen to the end of the sentence. But if you game the system and just were like orange and then said your own thing, understand that you weren't listening. So there's lessons to be learned by the skills building. And I find that. And we just had on your colleague, Michael Morris, with his book.
Yeah.
Which is also, you know, what I loved about that is like, we're not inherently pitted against each other. That obviously does happen. We all live in the world that we live in, but we share more. You know, and when we share more, and that's also out of our work in terms of self-disclosure, you start to see the other as human. You start to see the other as someone who has mind and someone who's part of, you know, potentially your greater tribe. Because we belong to many tribes, and those tribes change. If I switch jobs, if I get new families, whatever, it's that, you know, they're all part of the collective mix.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think like Michael's book is fantastic and is exactly about that. Yeah.
All right. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. So this is a time in your life where you normally would have said no, but you took a shot.
Okay. Yeah. So I have two of those. So one is about the book. So I didn't want it to write a book. Mm-hmm. And I was asked by an agent and I said like, no, I'm not sure I really want to do that and like get out there, you know,
have to do podcasts.
Yeah, I have to. Well, it was a positive experience with you, Kelly, but like, yeah, getting out there and like talking with strangers is not really my thing. And I said yes. And it was so far a really positive experience, especially when I can actually talk to people. I have to admit, the promotion part, like, you know, posting on LinkedIn and telling that I'm great, that's not what I enjoy. But like talking to people like you, you know, and having a conversation is really rewarding. The other part, the second one where I said yes and I didn't want it to at the beginning was I'm divorced. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want it to say yes a second time. And my now wife convinced me, like she was like, you will not regret this. And I was like, I'm not so sure. I didn't have that great of an experience the first time. And I said yes. And it was probably one of my best decisions I've made. I didn't anticipate, you know, how good it can be, how much it actually means to have this. You know, back then I thought like, there's nothing different, you know, or why should I be married? I mean, I was like, turns out I really enjoy it. And it was a great decision that came from something I didn't want to say. And I literally said yes in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah, you sure did. Marriage number two is killing it. We're doing great over here. So I get it. And same with my wife. The book is called The Employee Advantage, How Putting Workers First Helps Business Thrive. Stefan Meyer, thank you so much for being on the pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming at the top of their lungs.
survive.